Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. My ride or die and I here have off mic agreed there's one and only one way to introduce today's episode, and that's this: Shakespeare riots.
Riots!
That's as far as we got with the song, right?
Throw a chair up on the stage.
The Shakespeare riot.
Riot! This is, I don't know, I got nothing. What is it? Well, so this is a, let's see. It's over, the bard war I wage. Nope, nothing. Not good.
We'll look at the lyrics and spend some time, or maybe you can help us out with this. We're looking for Zoot Suit Riot, written as Shakespeare Riot, and we'd love to hear your take on the lyrics anywhere on the internet, Twitter, Instagram, or our Facebook page, Ridiculous Historians. Maybe we can come up with some of our own off air. How will I write this parody song, you may be asking yourself? Well, it's very simple. You'll learn all you need in today's episode.
Well, and the good news is I've already set the bar remarkably low with my ham-fisted attempt at this. But, you know, I was really, it was just right off the cuff. I didn't even think about this, Ben. You surprised me with this cherry popping daddy's ref. So please, Ridiculous Historians, do us a solid and make us proud. Write this song. It needs to exist. Weird Al hasn't done it. Who else is going to? I don't know. It could be you. But it's true. Today we're talking about a no-joke riot. Like, you know, practically burning things to the ground. I think there is an attempted arson at some point in this story. And it's all around. It's like in that time of New York City history, kind of like Gangs of New York era, if I'm not mistaken, with like the Bowery Boys and all of that stuff. Actually, that might be later. Forget I said anything about Gangs of New York. But it is sort of still that frontier kind of, like, you know, mentality of, like, you know, there's the very highfalutin old money types, which are pretty much British transplants who still are quite rich. And then there's like the new middle class. And then there's like the lower class. And a lot of that stuff, those crowds come together in entertainment. That's where the haves and the have-nots kind of meet. It's a tale as old as time. We see it throughout history. And America wasn't so much known as being like a theater place. It was very much a British thing. And obviously Shakespeare is the most famous British, you know, arguably, I think pretty much unquestionably, the most famous British playwright of all time. And this was now starting to, you know, show up in the States. But there still wasn't like a famous British equivalent to like the great British actors, you know? Mm. And this story is kind of about that American equivalent and the Hufflepuff. That's not the right word. The hubbub.
That's a good word.
the brouhaha. The brouhaha that those clashing factions created when, you know, people were feeling like maybe this gentleman was too lowbrow to tread the boards.
Right. And this is where, of course, we point out the notable absence of our super producer, Casey Pegram, who is still so upset by this historical event that he wasn't able to make it to the recording today. We're with you, Casey, and you're joining us in spirit, but we understand how you're still a little sore about the issue.
His very sensibilities of all that is good were so shaken that he had to take a sick day today.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. That's the ticket. That's the theater ticket. You're right, Nolan. I love the way that you have set out the stage for our story today. You see, one of the biggest incidents of public outrage and pandemonium in the entire history of the Big Apple was really a fight about theater. And we're going to learn how a tremendously difficult feud between two actors led to widespread chaos. So let's introduce our two principal actors for this story, who are also actors themselves. There's England's William MacCready, and from the U.S., there's Edwin Forrest. Now, both of these guys were already big deals. They were professional actors. They were in their glory days. They had each toured the other's country mm-hmm. in various productions, mm-hmm. and they were known on both sides of the pond. But MacCready sort of represented that old school idea of Shakespearean or British actors. Forrest was a young gun. In every sense of the word, he was 13 years younger than William, and he also represented this sort of new school of actors who came from an American background.
Yeah, that's right. It's like you think of, oh, what's that Saturday Night Live sketch where is it Mike Myers who does the whole acting, that thing?
John yeah. Lovitz?
John Lovitz, acting, that's right. And yeah, it's definitely like that tradition of very large kind of, almost scenery chewing kind of attitude of that kind of Shakespearean acting where it's all about big performances. Because as we know, stage acting requires big performances. Otherwise, those gestures and glances and looks and nuances that might be easier to see on a screen with a zoomed in camera, you can't do that on a stage when you're maybe, 100 feet away. And the cheap seats or more even. So you really got to kind of like sell it. And that is what MacCready represented, the traditional style of Great Britain and classical British theater. Forrest, who was much younger, he brought a different kind of bravado to the stage. It's possible that I'm overstating the bigness of British acting because it was possibly of the two, the more nuanced, but it had a little bit more of an effete quality to it, a little bit more of a daintiness and delicate nature. And this Forrest guy was all, piss and vinegar and bigness and machismo. And American audiences flipped for this guy. First of all, because he was one of their own, mm-hmm. given those British conquerors what for, in the theatrical sense. But he had really started to develop kind of a distinct cultural identity for American theater that was different from that British school.
And I would argue, well, first off, I have rarely been a professional actor in my life. I mainly did sketch comedy and a couple few serious pieces, but I would argue that this difference exists in a form today. Very quickly, for instance, imagine some of the most famous American actors, people like Al Pacino. That's always going to be seen as Al Pacino on camera, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. it's less chameleon-like. There's something to be said, and I'm not sure how to phrase it. There's something to be said to the idea that European actors are often lauded for their ability to become subsumed in a role,
right.
while many U.S. actors are lauded for their ability to kind of always be themselves.
Hey, it's me, Robert De Niro, Bobby De Niro. I'm playing a French Duke in this movie, but this is still how I do, you mm-hmm. know?
Or Keanu Reeves, may science and the gods bless him. He seems like such a great guy, but man, if you rewatch Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, which I thoroughly enjoy.
Yeah.
That accent is tough. I know where the bastard sleeps.
Exactly. Yeah, but you know what? He never got cast in a role like that ever again. And I would argue that Keanu Reeves is a secret weapon, a magic bullet when used properly. And I think I saw an article, not to get too off topic, about how he is sort of one of the most underappreciated actors in American cinema. And that's largely because people just think he's a dummy and he doesn't really know what he's doing. But yet, why? Why is he so beloved? It's not just coincidence. It's not just because he's cute. There's something to Keanu Reeves. He brings a kindness and a sort of empathy to his roles. And I think that really translates. And that's why he's such a big deal.
And I think that all of the actors we have mentioned thus far and many that we haven't mentioned thus far are in their own way profoundly talented. I think it's kind of lazy for people to just heap opprobrium on an actor. There's usually going to be a reason that they're in so many films, right? Mm-hmm. Professionals assessed their abilities and found them more than adequate. So kudos to you all. It is tremendously difficult work to be a working actor. And you live and die by the fans, right? That's true for any entertainment. That's true for K-pop and groups like BTS. That's true for sports teams and more. These actors each had their own fan clubs, and they were like soccer hooligan level or football hooligan level opposed to each other.
That's right.
The wealthy upper class Anglophiles in England and in the U.S., they were MacReady people.
Mm-hmm.
The working class, the folks who were like, yeah, I like theater. What, does that surprise you? I can't like theater. I work, you know, at the docks and I go see Macbeth. What's wrong with that? This is America, baby. Those folks liked Forrest.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Ben, I mean, this is also pre what we might consider some of the more base, lowbrow types, forms of entertainment in the States. Things like cabaret or things like vaudeville, you know, like, so at the time, the reason there was such a clash between these two classes was because this was really the only game in town, was this kind of classical theater, you know, like, I don't know that, I mean, I'm sure there were some other things that were approaching what I'm talking about, but it certainly wasn't that goal. Golden era yet, where there were like a much more of a bawdy type of crowd that maybe the highbrows wouldn't go to. They were occupying the same theaters, checking out the same performances that were largely classical works, not classical at the time, but things by Shakespeare, maybe even Greek theater or Rome, what have you. So there was definitely this interesting opportunity for culture clash to take place. And boy, do we have a good one coming. But real quick, let's just a little further sum up kind of these individual actors' style. William Charles MacReady was known for that kind of more fey, effet kind of handkerchief waving, as is how Smithsonian Magazine refers to it, in his portrayal of Hamlet. And he was a beloved portrayer of Hamlet. That was one of his most famous roles. Forrest, on the other hand, like we said, took it with a little bit more of a blunt instrument approach.
Yeah, and Forrest was more of the Shakespearean protagonist as action hero. You know what I mean?
There you go.
This guy was here to kick ass and spit quatrains. And I have no idea if that's correct. But here's the thing. They also became symbols, as we've sort of been foreshadowing, of anti-English and pro-English sentiment. We have to remember, this was like just maybe two generations after the Revolutionary War. That means it was still a hot topic. So even the word English was considered to kind of a sideways dig against the wealthy, mm-hmm, in the U.S. and what were seen as their British sympathies. Shakespeare, oddly enough, escaped this anti-English sentiment. Americans loved Shakespeare. They loved the stories. They loved the writing. They just wanted no part of what they saw as the foreign stage direction. They were like, yeah, Forrest, this guy, this bust heads and take names approach to British protagonists. That's what we need, not this uptight formality. And while that might seem weird, we have to remember this was pre-internet, this was pre-telephone, pre-television. So traveling performers were often seen as representatives of their own countries, whether they liked it or not. So when a lot of people would see MacReady, they would think, okay, this is what every single British person is like.
How interesting is that, Ben? It sort of goes to what I was talking about earlier, that maybe it had to do with just a lack of options. But, you know, now we think of Shakespeare as something that you learn in college. And, you know, we might occasionally get like a Baz Luhrmann adaptation of one that's got like boobs and, you know, violence and chopping heads and things like that. So there's definitely still a little bit of that populist sentiment around Shakespeare, but much less so. There's an article on the Santa Fe New Mexicans website that kind of tells the story of this rivalry that categorizes it like this. Prospectors and trappers recited Shakespeare around campfires, reading from battered volumes carried in their packs, or cobbling together heartfelt pastiches from memory. Really fascinating. This really was kind of the people's, he was the people's bard, you know?
Right. Yeah. Voice of the people. And so let's dive into how MacReady and Forrest became such such bitter pills toward one another. It all started years back. MacReady had toured the United States, and Forrest more or less emulated him. He performed the same roles that MacReady was known for at different theaters across the country, and the public loved this idea of dueling actors. There's almost like a WWE vibe here, because there was this transatlantic rivalry supporting that one actor or another in a role became kind of a statement of one's sentiments regarding the transatlantic rivalry at large. And so when Forrest went to England, the crowds came out. There were butts in the seats. There were groundlings in the groundling area. And when he came back to England later in the mid-1840s for a second tour, you can read a great article about this on Thought Co., the crowds were sparse. Did Forrest blame his performance? Did he blame the source material, or did he blame the production team? No, he blamed MacReady. That son of a fish, he said.
I was sabotaged.
Yeah, I was sabotaged. And so he physically showed up at a performance that MacReady was involved in and started heckling him from the audience, like, hiss, boo.
You know, it's funny. I read another article about this, or I think I watched, no, I know what it was. There's this guy I've been really enjoying on YouTube. He goes by the History Guy, and he does these kind of short little, quick blasts through like interesting little history stories. And we've referenced him a few times on the show, but he talks about how these guys kind of knew each other, or they had at least crossed paths, and they were friendly to a point. And then things got nasty. But you got to wonder, it's like these hip hop beefs we see today. You got to wonder if there's calculation behind them sometimes, where it's sort of like, hey, no press is bad press. Maybe if we drum up some kind of like rivalry, it'll up our returns on both ends. Doesn't seem like that was the case here, because there was actual loss of money happening, because it was like, okay, you're gonna cause me to not have as many people come to the show. I'm gonna show up and hiss from the box seats, and that really set things on a collision course for disaster.
Mm-hmm. And we know this is the case, because okay, so this is when the rivalry begins. So Forrest shows up in Edinburgh when MacReady is performing Hamlet, as you guessed it, Hamlet. And oddly enough, theater was much more interactive at this level than is maybe considered to be today, because it wasn't uncommon for a spectator to heckle. And MacReady may have gone on and just taken that in stride, his bruised ego aside, but he recognized that it was Forrest. And then Forrest went in and wrote a letter to the London Times where he defended his behavior. He said it was, quote, a salutary and wholesome corrective to the abuses of the stage. The truth is, Mr. MacReady thought fit to introduce a fancy dance into his performance of Hamlet, which I thought, and still think, a desecration of the scene, and at which I evinced that disapprobation.
What is a fancy dance? Like a little jig?
I got it. Maybe he twerked. Who knows?
Who knows? That would be a first. And then MacReady, in true dandy British fashion, made a very snippy entry in his diary where he commented on the affair as such. I do not think that such an action has a parallel in all theatrical history. The low-minded ruffian.
Perfect.
I think he's referring to Forrest there as a low. That is them's fighting words. Low-minded ruffian in those days might as well be, a serious effing and jeffing kind of slur.
Mm-hmm. And notice how that plays into the British stereotypes of knuckleheaded residents of the U.S. And it's weird because in Europe, MacReady is very well established. He has the infrastructure. He has the PR. They're on his side. And his supporters worked assiduously to ensure that Forrest's performances didn't get a lot of coverage in the press. So he wasn't getting the headlines and the ink that he wanted. And this sabotaged his obsession, one that should be familiar to many actors in the audience today, global fame. And then Forrest, in return, made it difficult for Reedy to play in the States. There was a performance MacReady had in Cincinnati, and the patrons, the audience members, the Secret Forrest fans, intentionally went there to try and sabotage the production. They threw half a dead sheep onto the stage. And these guys kept like snipping each other back and forth in the press. So to your point, Noel, I don't know how sincere they were. I think the two actors were sincere, but I am sure there were promoters and so on who were fanning the flames because they realized it was good publicity.
And this back and forth in the press, these kind of little digs just went on and on and on, and really began to just kind of deepen those resentments on both sides of the divide. Like you said, the Anglophile halves, you know, in the MacReady camp, and the more working class, you know, football hooligan types, not to oversimplify, in the Forrester camp. And it all was heading to a battleground situation where things would ultimately kind of boil over in a pretty remarkable fashion.
We have our characters, we have our context. Now let's look at our figurative and literal stage. The theater at Astor Place is in a wealthy neighborhood. Broadway should be familiar to everybody else. It is within shouting distance of the Bowery, which is working class. The Bowery Theater is where Forrest made his stage debut, and it's where neighborhood street gangs known as Bohoys, B-apostrophe-H-O-Y-S, went to while out. They would throw peanuts. They would holler along with the works of Shakespeare, or they would climb on stage and try to mess with the actors. The Astor Place Theater was the polar opposite. Velvet seats. You got to show up with white gloves. Monocles not required, but encouraged.
Totally.
basically, it was considered scandalous if someone showed up to the Astor Place Theater not in an expensive carriage. So, of course, that's where MacReady goes.
That's right. And, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show the idea of kind of that new-ish working class, the Bowery Boys and things like that. There was a gang, but they also were just kind of a group of, you know, street toughs that kind of hung around the Bowery neighborhood. So you definitely had, it wasn't very far from where the Astor Theater was. So there was, you know, it was easy for them to kind of like get wind that there was going to be this event and decide they were going to, you know, not co-opt it exactly, but a bit of a party crashing situation. So when MacReady gets this kind of engagement at the Astor Place Theater in 1849 in the spring, this would be his third tour of the United States. It was essentially fighting words, you know, as far as the Bowery Boys and that kind of echelon of society were concerned. So on May 7th, 1849, MacReady was about to hit the stage as Macbeth in the Scottish play, is what they call it. And that's when these working class New York folks who had bought tickets started filing into the Astor Opera House, which is the official name of the place. And it was actually, if I'm not mistaken, they had previously only done opera, and then they started to kind of diversify a little bit because I think they wanted to, I don't know, like broaden the reach, I guess, and make more money. That's just the way it looks from my perspective. So it started to get a little rough feeling, and you started to see, you know, a lot of these folks that were more used to the white glove and monocle situation were started to see this other contingent kind of filing in, and it sort of gave them a little bit of pause. MacReady went on stage, started to deliver the first of his lines, and was immediately jeered, booed, hissed at. And there were things like three groans for the English bulldog.
Huzzah for native talent.
They wouldn't have said it in an English accent. They weren't English at all. I don't know why I said that. It was
maybe
fun to say it that
mocking.
Way.
Maybe they were mocking.
There you go. Let's assume that's the case. Huzzah for the native talent. Exactly. I love huzzah. Huzzah is universal. You don't have to be British or American to use huzzah. And things just got worse from there. Apparently, it got so noisy that the performers had to kind of continue the performance in pantomime because you couldn't even hear the dialogue. And yeah. Then things escalated from there in terms of like things getting chucked on stage, right?
Yeah, yeah. My favorite part of this story is the same crowd cheered when McDuff first enters the story. He's, as you recall, Shakespeare fans, he's the character who goes on to kill Macbeth. Spoilers. So that's how profoundly they hated MacReady. And the stage wasn't just pelted with playbills or peanuts. People had brought things to throw at him. Eggs, bottles, pennies, rotten fruit. Yes, that really used to happen. People would throw rotten fruit at actors. And eventually, they had to end the performance before the play itself was done. At the same time, across town, Forrest, by the way, is doing his own performance of Macbeth to a packed house of his own supporters. And this made MacReady livid in a very, you know, buttoned up British way. He said, "I'm going to cancel my tour. I'm leaving this godforsaken country for good." Mm-hmm. And it took some of New York's most highly regarded elites begging him for him to, you know, reluctantly change his mind, the society folks, the literary giants. And so they said, okay, we're going to do another performance. We're going to call it a premiere. We're going to do it 3 days later. And that's where they messed up, because this, fellow ridiculous historians, gave the authorities time to prepare. But it also gave it also gave those mutual fan clubs time to prepare.
Unless we need to really not bury the lead here. This was more than just like drunken heckling. This, like we said, this represented serious tensions between the upper and lower and middle classes, and also the pro-British versus staunchly anti-anything foreign sentiments. So, I mean, this was serious business. This represented something very real, even if it was just kind of like, you know, it seems a little frivolous talking about it now. I was like, what? It was just a freaking play. It's basically just like getting bent out of shape about, like, you know, a movie or something, which, not to say people don't do that, but certainly not to this degree. There was a militia assembled. A 350 person militia was assembled, and it was stationed at Washington Square Park on the ready, right, Ben? And they were kind of expecting that there was going to be some trouble. And that was assembled by the city's mayor, who was a Whig. That's a holdover from British governing, right?
Yeah, the Whig Party, which is no longer active now, was pretty active in the 1800s. They were an oppositional party. They rose to oppose President Andrew Jackson. So their main constituents, or their main components, were former members of the Democratic Party, the Anti-Masonic Party, which is a good thing for an episode later, and the National Republican Party.
Got it. So would they have been more pro-British or more pro, you know, British sentiment? Or is this not even something that is worth considering in this situation?
They, you know, it's almost an episode of its own. They ultimately self-destructed over the question of whether or not slavery should be expanded to the territories in the country at the time. So
okay.
there were a lot of what we would call haves in the Whig Party.
Okay, so this would have largely, this 350-man militia, we could probably consider them kind of in the MacReady camp.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
There to oppose the unwashed masses and their hooliganry, right?
Yeah. Oh, also, Abraham Lincoln was a leader of the Whig Party in Illinois once upon a time. So, not, you know, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush there. But yes, the 350-man-strong militia was organized to stop any potential shenanigans on the part of Forrest supporters. So we fast forward, May 10th, 1849, the second performance, still called a premiere for marketing purposes.
That's right. That's right. And let's also point out, we may have glossed over this, this was essentially the rich contingent saying, how dare you treat our beloved MacReady in this way, you absolute trash human beings. We are going to be completely tone deaf about what this feud represents, and we just think he deserves a mulligan because you were so dastardly to him with your rudeness and your pelting of eggs and all of that. They probably should have left well enough alone, Ben, not realizing this was actually the match that could ignite an actual powder keg. Well, not an actual literal powder keg, a figurative powder keg, or an actual riot or conflict in the streets. But they were more concerned about coming off as refined to this gentleman and making sure that he would return to regale them with his handkerchief waving performances in future engagements.
Yeah, that's the thing. There was a lot of let us subjugate the lower class, teach them a lesson kind of reasoning behind their activities. I could just see, I can see the members of high society shaking their hands at the ceiling of their chandelier and going, the uncouthery of it all, the sheer uncouthery. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Things got shady so quickly. 200 officers from the police force were inside the theater. 75 more were outside, but the crowd easily outnumbered them. We're talking about more than 10,000 people, and people in the crowd learned of an unethical trick the MacReady contingent had pulled in advance of the play. You see, they intentionally oversold the tickets for the show, and this gave the ushers the opportunity to, as the Smithsonian Mental Floss phrase it, weed out the riffraff and still have a sold-out premiere. So They did this, by the way, because MacReady's agents sold tickets that had a special identifying mark that said to the ushers, these are the people we actually want in the theater. So the Forrest supporters who managed to get in the first place found themselves cherry-picked and arrested during the first act of the play, and the crowd of MacReady fans were loudly cheering as they saw these people get dragged off. And then that's when, eventually, the prisoners set their holding cell on fire. One man yelling, I paid for a ticket and they wouldn't let me in because I hadn't kid gloves and a white vest. Damn them.
Kid gloves? Is that where that expression comes from?
Yeah, it's kind of, goat skin.
Yeah, oh, got it. Kid, I always assumed handling things with kid gloves meant like having to deal with a small child. I was always confused with what are these gloves for children? Like, I'm confused. It makes perfect sense. Kid gloves, Mersey dotes and dozy dotes and all that stuff. Kids isn't even in that rhyme. What am I talking about? I just Google it. It's a funny rhyme about types of goats or something. But yeah, it's true. People started throwing bricks, or as they referred to them in those days, paving stones. And it was, absolute bedlam. Windows were being broken. The opera house really started to look like that scene in Les Mis, with the barricade in the middle of the street and burning refuse piled up in like a weird pyramid. And it's absolutely a scene, like something out of a war movie inside an opera house.
So now the opera house is starting to look like it is under siege. Like there's some sort of army invading it. Police and the state militia try to keep the crowds away from the theater. One General William Hall told the mayor straight up, look, it's time to open fire on these people, or it's time to pull back because I am not going to let my guys get stoned to death while they're carrying guns. So just give us the order, mayor. It's time to ship or get off the pot. So this is where a man in the crowd shouts, Fire it. Burn that damned den of the aristocracy.
Oh, and then the continuation of this quote is priceless. You danced fire, you sons of you danced. What does that mean? And that's the anonymous voice that rose above the crowd. Oh, working men, shall Americans or English rule? And then, yeah, the soldiers apparently did danced, and they fired.
Yeah, I was interested in this because in this Stephen King novel, The Shining, without spoiling it, there is a scene where one character in an exasperated tone is yelling out, "You dasn't. You dasn't." Like, you dare not.
I don't know that one, Ben.
So it's an outdated kind of archaic expression now, but I was looking into "you dasn't." Does that mean you dare not fire? Like, were they daring the soldiers to fire?
You dare not fire?
Yeah.
You dare not. I think maybe darsn't is dare not, perhaps. I don't know. It's hard to say. We can only make our best guess. But again, they did open fire. The soldiers volleyed some shots over the crowd's heads. They were meant more to be warning shots to kind of get them to simmer down a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it didn't really have the desired effect. And people kept, you know, hurling these paving stones and all of that. And that's when the soldiers decided to take it to the next level, and they set their sights and they actually fired into the crowd.
Yep. And the crowd continued surging forward. It was only until this militia threatened to use cannon fire that the crowds dispersed. And once everything had settled, relatively speaking, there were 18 people dead on the street, murdered by this militia, and there were dozens more people who were injured, not all of them involved in the riots. Some people probably just like walking to the deli and getting caught up in this cacophony, this cavalcade of chaos. More than 100 rioters were arrested. And we have an account we found reprinted in the Washington Post from 1849 that says, "The scene which followed beggars all description. The wounded, the dying, and the dead were scattered in every direction. There were groans of agony, cries for help, and oaths of vengeance. Some of the dead and wounded were laid out upon the billiards table of Vauxhall Saloon. A large crowd gathered around, and speeches were made by excited orators." And it goes on to list the number of people killed, injured, and arrested. But it also, and this is interesting, it prints their occupations and background information about them. They're people like people who work at grocery stores, carpenters, waiters, stuff like that.
Not to take it in too contemporary a political direction, but as we know, the problem with riots and looting and all of that is people do get caught in the crossfire. And oftentimes people that are there with the best of intentions that are playing by the rules get lumped in with the quote unquote bad actors, right? And then and if lethal force is involved, that's a whole nother ballgame, because then everyone kind of gets swept up into the melee. And it's a nasty scene. There was a bystander by the name of Bridget Fagan, who was 30 years old, shot in the leg while walking with her husband just along the Bowery. Or a gentleman named George Gedney, 34, who is a Wall Street stockbroker, who was shot right through the head while watching all of this stuff unfold from in front of one of the very posh mansions in that part of the city. So even people that weren't even there, like you said, had nothing to do with it, got caught up in all of this violence. And then you have to, the thing about riots too, is that there's got to be a narrative, and there's always this kind of rush to blame somebody or figure out, you know, who the one person or contingent that, you know, actually was the cause of said violence was, when usually it's a combination of multiple parties. Not to mention the massive overcorrection by the city's, I would say, not technically legal police supplement, you know, with these militia people who are going to be much more trigger happy than maybe trained officers. I don't know. I don't even know if that's true or not, but it certainly feels like it was quite an overreaction. And it was Irish immigrants that were blamed. The Irish always get blamed, it seems like, in a lot of these situations. But the true evidence pointed to anti-immigrants immigrant forces, much more than actual, you know, immigrants themselves.
Yeah, so very much in line with that Gangs of New York kind of dichotomy that you mentioned at the top there, Noel. But what about the most controversial British actor in New York City? MacReady hightailed it out first through a back exit of the theater, and then he hightailed it to his posh hotel. And then, because he was worried that the mob would lay siege to his hotel and then kill him, he hightailed it from New York entirely. In a few days, he was in Boston. But what about the aftermath here?
Oh, what about it indeed? And real quickly, just to backtrack, I made what was kind of just an off-the-cuff assertion at the top that this was during the time period of the Gangs of New York, and then I realized I hadn't confirmed that, so I sort of walked that back. But no, the Gangs of New York period with all of those huge gang wars was only a very brief period, and it was from 1834 to 1844, and this is in 1849, so this really is like right part and parcel with that whole vibe in the city.
Right, but that's why I said that I thought your comparison was spot on, because we still see the anti-Irish sentiments.
Yes, and absolutely. For some reason, I just thought maybe it would have been farther removed, but it really was like right on the heels of that. So that stuff would have just absolutely still been in the air. So to your point, that's absolutely right.
The news of the day was, was very consciously oriented toward heaping opprobrium upon that Irish-American population. We're not in any way diminishing that, but they were opportunists for sure. The media, I mean, not the Irish population in New York.
No question about it. They absolutely had their own agendas and axes to grind. And we actually have a recollection from Major General Charles Stanford, who led that New York militia, of the events that took place. And this is what he said: "I have never seen a mob so violent as the one on that evening. I never before had occasion to give the order to fire." And then, you know, after the riot, there were bodies strewn in the streets. I mean, it really was like something out of a war movie, only it was much more of like a civil war kind of situation. It really truly was a mini civil war between the haves and the have-nots, all over which version of Macbeth they liked the best, but representing something much larger.
Yeah, that's how it started. One thing that people don't often talk about when they talk about the story is the second riot that almost occurred, with people marching like an army in Lower Manhattan. That riot was quelled, and a few days after the first riot, a jury relieved the police and militia of any and all responsibility for the shootings, saying that they were justified. Five more people died of their wounds in the days after. So the total fatalities of this riot were 23 people dead, but maybe as many as 31. And people who were seen as instigators of the riots were up for trial as well. Many were convicted, fined, and jailed, including that author, Ned Buntline, who was one of the people shouting in the crowd. He wasn't the guy who was like, "You darsn't," but he was hanging out with those folks. Forrest continued performing after this. They both continued performing after this, and this is, I don't know what to think about this one, Noel, but he eventually had this dramatic falling out and divorce from his English wife, and went on to perform regularly until he passed away suddenly in 1872 at the age of 66.
And, you know, Astor Place, this area and the theater that you know it was centered around, already had a reputation as being kind of a hot spot for the wealthy and powerful, and the kind of like shining tower on the hill, you know, where the elite were able to live and work and play. And it just kind of continued to deepen those resentments, right? Especially after, you know, loss of life that resulted. It was about more than just Shakespeare and which actor you liked the best. It really was kind of a almost like a French Revolution type experience, like almost like a mini revolution. And it did go down in history as one of the most violent riots in the city's history until the 1863 draft riots that took place during the Civil War. So it's, you know, interchangeably referred to as the Shakespeare riot or the Astor Place riot. And this had immediate impacts that resonated not just in New York City, but around the country. New York City police were armed at this point, or I guess they hadn't been. And then municipal constables around the country were also armed. And the word spread through the relatively new invention that was the telegraph. And this is when you start to see a little bit more of almost the earliest days of the militarization of the police. You know, the idea of like a police state or something. It's pretty fascinating. You know, up until that point, a lot of the beat cops would just be walking around with like nightsticks, for example. And now they were carrying heavy firepower and there was more heavy weaponry given to police departments and things like armored vehicles and such.
Yeah, that's why you'll see authors such as Jonathan Richards writing for Santa Fe, New Mexican, saying that this sets a precedent for the path of increased militarization and in arguing that you can trace it back there. I don't think the answer is as clear cut, but there's definitely something to the argument. This also marked what people call the beginning of the end for Shakespeare as popular entertainment in the U.S., because now the secret that everybody knew, but no one really talked about, of alienation between the various American classes was front and center, like someone doing a monologue in Shakespeare. It was right there for all to see, and it had a spotlight upon it, perhaps for the first time. So the culture of the country shifted, and Shakespeare, for good or ill, started to become regarded as more of a highbrow form of entertainment. And I do want to take this moment to point out that Shakespeare is still very accessible and super enjoyable if you get the chance to see a solid production of it on stage. The shows are a lot of fun. They're worth the price of a ticket. And perhaps most importantly, you don't have to riot to have a riotous good time.
Well said, Ben. Well said. Way to bring it full circle so we can wrap this one up for today. Huge thanks to super producer Casey Pregram here in spirit today, along with Christopher Hasiois. They're kind of hovering above us in the clouds, looking down on us like good ghost parents. And I really appreciate that, as always.
Yeah. And of course, huge thanks to the Quister, also known as Jonathan Strickland, who is going to be a little bit dumpling steamed to know that we didn't have him on a Shakespeare episode, but we'll make it up to him. And of course, big thanks to Gabe Luzier, however you wish to pronounce it, for some awesome research alley-oops with this one.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Eve's Jeff Coates. Check out her show, This Day in History Class, along with some amazing new things that she's got in the works that I can't talk about quite yet, but be on the lookout. Big things coming from Eve's. And man, Ben, thanks to you for joining me in this Shakespeare riot and throwing back a bottle of good tidings and great joy.
And Noel, thanks for shotgunning with me on this one without either of us actually firing a shotgun, which apparently sets the bar of podcasting a little bit higher than the bar of mid-1800 Shakespeare performances. I don't know if there's an Emmy for that or a Webby, but you know, you can just reward us by hanging out with us on the internet, where we are Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're Ridiculous History or some derivation thereof. But of course, the best place to find us, and more importantly, your fellow listeners, is to join Ridiculous Historians, our Facebook page.
Yes, all you have to do is name one or both or anybody part of the Ridiculous History mythos, and you'll be in, and lots of good times to be had there. You can also check out me and Ben as individual human beings on the internet. I am at HowNowNoelBrown on Instagram.
I am at Ben Bolin, HSW on Twitter, and I am at Ben Bolin on Instagram, where I go through various weird visual phases. Like right now, I live with a life-size plastic skeleton, because that's where I am in the age of pandemic.
Hey, we're all somewhere doing our best every day. Please join us for the next episode of Ridiculous History, where super producer Casey Pegram will return from his sick leave, and hopefully we'll make him proud. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.